This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
Hello there and welcome to the Bite Size Business Breakfast. It is a Monday, the 27th of March. Here's what we've got for you today. Going to jump straight into a couple of big economic stories, including Donald Trump on the campaign trail. What are his thoughts on inflation, on energy and Saudi Arabia? We're going to hear from him. Plus, breaking news, while we were on air this morning, Al Ansari Exchange, the IPO, has closed. Going to get the thoughts of the investment expert, Samir Lakhani. What else have we got for you? Big focus on gold today. John Reed is chief market strategist at the World Gold Council. A little bit later on, going to hear from Jeff Rhodes, the Ras Al Khaimah-based gold expert, talking prices, talking interest rates, and also, I'm not going to lie, talking about a new TV series that me and Tom absolutely love called The Gold. It's about a gold heist 40 years ago in London. By some measures, the biggest robbery in the history of the world of anything. About 100 million quid at today's prices. Anyway, all that to come. And finally, school fees. They are rising, but not at every school. David Wesley is the co-founder of Which Media, which produces whichschooladvisor.com. His thoughts on rising school fees in both affordable schools, but also premium schools. All that to come. First up, though, the Donald and economics. Donald Trump in the United States has been speaking, Thomas, not in California, but in Texas, which is Trump heartland, isn't it? It was a long speech. There was a lot in it. We're the Business Breakfast, so we're focusing on the economics, which, let's be honest, isn't the most interesting bit. But never mind that. This is what he had to say. And forgive the audio quality. It's not brilliant, but it's okay. You can hear it. This is what Trump had to say about the economy and inflation.
Inflation nightmare and rebuild the greatest economy in the history of the world, just like we had it before.
The greatest economy in the history of the world. One of the things he did focus on, which was interesting and does impact us here in the UAE, was energy. This is what he had to say about energy, in particular hydrocarbons.
Our energy independence and energy dominance as we had just a few short years ago. Proud Texas energy workers will once again be pumping, producing, and refining Texas oil and gas to turn America into the number one energy superpower on Earth.
The number one energy superpower on Earth. And he had some words for Saudi Arabia as well.
So we had it there. We had it. We were doing more than Saudi Arabia, but we were number one. I would have been bigger than both of them combined in a short period of time. And then they did what they've done.
They being the Biden administration and some of their policies towards hydrocarbons. We've been getting some analysis of this from energy expert Dr. Sara Vakshuri. She's based in the United States, in Washington, D.C. She joined us earlier on this morning. This is what she had to say, her reflection on those comments, that policy agenda, if you like, on energy from Donald Trump.
Well, it's very important and interesting because many people in the United States, especially on the Republican side, there are so many critics of President Biden's administration's energy policy, energy approach, and where U.S. is now standing globally in terms of energy positioning itself in the world. So there are so many different factors that not just Trump, but Republican are going to argue in the next year's presidential election. Mostly is, especially after the Ukraine-Russia war, the importance of energy security and energy independence, especially for United States, relying on its own resources, oil, natural gas, and coal in a clean manner. It's important. Also, the other issue that is very critical, and there are maybe not so much discussion publicly yet about that, is the issue of nuclear energy and where U.S. is positioning itself versus Russia. Russia is having a huge dominance, especially on the fuel cycle. And now that, again, energy security is an important component of energy system for countries, especially after Russia-Ukraine war, nuclear energy might be and is going to be an important part of the energy system and energy mix for many countries. So Republicans are going to have a lot of focus on energy when it comes to next year's presidential election.
And Dr. Saravak Shuri joining us from Washington, D.C. Let's get some local perspective on this now. Khatija Haque is chief economist, Emirates MBD. She's been following this closely. She was looking at and watching Donald Trump's speech over the weekend, looking for clues about his economic agenda, whether it's inflation, whether it's energy, as we just heard, or perhaps his trade relationship with China. This is what Khatija had to say.
In terms of U.S. energy policy, he claimed that he would boost investment and U.S. energy production, and in doing so, effectively get rid of inflation, because in his view, inflation is caused or was caused just by higher energy prices. Presumably, this would be done by rolling back regulations and environmental protections in order to increase investment into the energy sector in the United States. In terms of the relationship with China and trade, he continues to, again, prioritize investment in American manufacturing and technology. He indicated that he would wean the United States off all critical imports from China within 4 years, again, most likely through the use of various trade barriers and tariffs.
Khatija Haque there. On energy, though, I think it's worth noting that within the past 2 weeks, President Biden has approved what's called the Willow Project in Alaska in the Arctic Circle. It's a project with ConocoPhillips, the energy company, to produce up to 180,000 barrels a day of oil. It's an $8 billion project. Now, you can either praise Biden for that, or you can criticize him for that, whatever it may be. Make your own choices. But he has signed off on a major oil exploration and production project in Alaska within the past couple of weeks. Finally, on the global economy, Kristalina Georgieva has been speaking in China at a big event, same one that Tim Cook of Apple was speaking at. And she says 2023 is going to be a challenging year for the global economy. She blames three factors: scarring from the pandemic, the war in Ukraine, and also monetary tightening, higher interest rates. We asked Khatija Haque, what is Emirates MBD's house view on the global economy this year, and how will all of these factors impact the UAE?
2023 is likely to be a challenging year for the global economy. While growth remains relatively resilient and unemployment is near record lows, higher interest rates are causing some stress in the financial system. To some extent, this was to be expected and is part and parcel of what tightening financial conditions means. Central banks now have to thread the needle between containing inflation, which is still far too high and very sticky in developed economies, with managing the impact of higher rates on the real economy. Uncertainty is high and things are likely to develop in a non-linear way, causing volatility in financial markets. We think the Fed is probably near the end of its hiking cycle, but we do think that the market's expectations for rate cuts in the second half of this year are premature.
Khatija Haque of Emirates MBD. It's the Business Breakfast, Dubai 103.8 FM. It's the holy month of Ramadan, but business continues, including the, could we call it an IPO boom?
I think so, yeah.
I think we can. There you go. It's an IPO boom.
Certainly was a lot of momentum at the end of last year. That has continued into this year. I mean, if I was going to be uber critical, I maybe thought there might have been a few more. I mean, we talk about this year and I sort of suddenly think, well, yeah, but it's only the beginning of the year. We're almost 4 months, you know, almost 4 months into the year.
True.
So could we have had more cabs off the rank? Potentially. But the, I suppose it's not all, it's not about the numbers, is it? It's about the quality. It's not quantity, it's quality.
I agree with you there. And it's also the fact that this is Al Ansari Financial Services, which is a family firm.
Yeah.
So many of them so far have been essentially privatizations of government-related entities, whether it's in Abu Dhabi, divisions of ADNOC, whether it's SALIC, or whether it's TECOM, a division of Dubai Holding, which we work for. This is Al Ansari Financial Services, private company, family-owned business, foreign exchange firm. Here's what we found out this morning. It drew in 12.7 billion dirhams in bids for its IPO that closed at the end of last week. It's raised more than 700 million dirhams for the company. The sale of a 10% stake, global offering, it was oversubscribed 22 times. That's what we've learned this morning. We've been getting some insights on this by someone who follows it closely. Samir Lakhani, friend of the Business Breakfast, investor here in Dubai. He is managing director of Global Capital Partners, and this is what he told us.
By now, the oversubscription to the IPOs in Dubai and Abu Dhabi are not that much of a surprise. What is heartening and interesting is three high-level indicators. Number one, the size of the retail offering was increased, and despite that, the oversubscription was 44x, indicating a core retail base of investors that is increasing and looking for exposure into the remittance market. Number two, you're looking at the fact that it gives increasing levels of confidence to other family-owned businesses that are not backed by government entities to come out and list. Al Ansari has been the first, and they had stated quite publicly that they were quite proud of being the first. This gives confidence that there will be others to follow. Number three, you're seeing a widening investor base. You're seeing it at the retail level. You're seeing it at the institutional level. And all of this is translating into higher secondary market volumes as investors are starting to look at more and more towards the domestic and regional capital markets.
Sameer Lakhani there talking about Al Ansari Exchange, which has closed its IPO at the top end of its range.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
Crossing live to London for the latest on the yellow metal. And who better to speak to than the chief market strategist at the World Gold Council, live from London, John Reid, joins us on Microsoft Teams. Morning, John.
Good morning.
Thank you for getting up early to speak to us. So gold knocking on the door of $2,000, but not quite there yet. What's the story?
Well, the big story is as you said in the introduction, is the banking crisis that it seems to have come out of nowhere really in the last few weeks. That's returned speculative and investment interest into gold in ways we really haven't seen for a couple of years.
So who's buying at the moment? We spoke to one gold expert based here in the UAE earlier who said a lot of it is actually from central banks rather than private investors. What are you seeing at the council?
Yeah, central bank buying has been a really strong feature of the gold market, particularly in the second half of last year and through into this year. So central banks bought a record amount of gold in 2022, more than 1,100 tons, which is more than double, really, what they've been buying over the last decade or so. So that's been a big component of the gold market. Bar on coin investment as well. So if people getting their hands on physical gold has also been a big part of the story in gold. But much less so in ETF investors and futures market speculators. They really have been absent from the gold market for the last 6 months or so, until the last 2 weeks, when we've seen ETF investors, COMEX speculators, turn to gold, as you would expect during a banking crisis.
I follow you on Twitter, John, and you've had some interesting commentary recently, both your own and also retweeting various commentators, about cryptocurrencies, which have been touted as potentially a rival to you, if I can use that word, to gold as a safe haven asset. What do you make of what's happening with crypto at the moment? Just to outline your thesis for us.
Well, look, we've heard an awful lot about crypto in the last 5 years, and lots of claims that it's a threat to gold. That's not something we actually buy into. The research we've done, the papers we've published, shows that there's a clear difference between gold and cryptocurrencies in terms of what people expect from both of those assets and what they do when you put them into a portfolio. But there's no doubt that there's a lot of interest remaining in Bitcoin and other crypto assets, even despite the big sell-off that we've seen. So I'm sure the crypto markets will attract attention, and part of the founding narrative of Bitcoin was that it was independent from the banking system. So I'm not surprised at all that Bitcoin has gone up during these times. But whether that makes it an investment for everybody or not is a different question. I mean, it's extraordinarily volatile, facing lots of regulation, threats for all around the world, really. And you know, we're not experts on the crypto market, but what I do say to people is, you know, be very careful what you're doing there. And recognize that you've added a lot of risk to your portfolio if you own crypto. The best way to diversify that risk, like if you own a lot of equities, is to add some gold to your portfolio as a hedge.
What about getting gold out of the ground at the moment? Where do we stand with production? I know you've got a degree in mining engineering. That's how you began. You spent a lot of time working in South Africa. Where do we stand on getting it out of the ground and getting it into stores, such as the Gold Souk in Dubai?
Sure. I mean, look, gold mine output hit an all-time high in 2018 and has been affected by COVID, affected by other technical and safety issues around the world, but is recovering again, and it grew a little last year. We'll probably get close to the all-time high production in gold again in 2023, barring any major circumstances like a COVID shutdowns, etc. But I think the key thing is that gold production isn't really growing. Mining companies need to bring new projects on all the time, and those projects are coming at a relatively slow pace. And I'd expect to see production flat to maybe even slightly declining over the medium term because of the shortage of these new projects.
Let's talk about interest rates. The Federal Reserve has been raising for the past year or so. We think we're probably coming to the end of the tightening cycle. I mean, traditionally, 25 years ago when I was being taught how to be a business journalist, we were told that gold would move inversely to the US dollar. A higher dollar would mean lower gold. I'm not sure that relationship still holds. But how are you reading the interest rate policy from the Fed and its impact on gold?
Well, you're absolutely right. Interest rates and the US dollar are the two big market factors that drive gold in the short and medium term. Over the longer term, supply and demand fundamentals really do matter. But in the short term, if you get your dollar view right and you get your interest rate view right, then you're probably going to call the gold market right. So if we are coming to the end of the Fed hiking cycle and we can start to anticipate declines in interest rates in maybe towards the end of this year or into next year, I'm probably not as expecting as many cuts as are priced into the curve at the moment. But that should be an environment where gold does well. Typically, when at the start of a Fed cutting cycle, gold starts to perform well and continues for some time. So if that works out, then certainly that could be a real tailwind for gold over the next few years.
John, can't let you go without asking you about a TV series that my co-host Tom and I are obsessed with at the moment. You're based in London. It's called The Gold. It's about the Brinks Matt gold robbery 40 years ago. Going to ask you your thoughts in a second, but first of all, here's a brief blast from the trailer.
Gold like that, you can't control it. And if you can't handle it, then it will find its way to someone who can.
Six robbers have carried out an armed raid, stealing almost 3 tons of gold bullion.
So our friend says you can shift it.
You can handle a job like this, and out of earlier,
you only hear about the people who get caught.
We're looking for 6 robbers and 3 tons of gold.
And by some reckoning, the biggest robbery of anything ever in history happened 40 years ago from a warehouse just outside Heathrow Airport. My co-host Tom and I are obsessed with this TV series. Is the London gold market watching it?
I think they are. I certainly have been. And I've been impressed, actually, the way that they've done it. They seem to have got all the big things right about it, not least of which the problems of if you end up with 3 tons of gold in the UK, what do you do with it? How do you turn that into money? I was actually sitting there watching the first episode thinking, what would I do if 3 tons of gold happened to turn up in my garden illegally and I needed to actually turn it into cash? And the answer is, I don't actually really know. And I think that's the real conundrum about this this TV program is, what do they do with it? How do they make it into money? And it causes all manner of difficulties, as you'll know.
Great speaking to you. Appreciate your time this morning. Thanks very much indeed for joining us live on the line. That's the chief market strategist and TV critic from the World Gold Council, live from London, John Reid. Appreciate your time this morning.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Talk school fees if we can. Why? Because the KHDA, the Dubai Knowledge and Human Development Authority, last week stating that private schools are now eligible for a 3% increase in tuition fees for the 23 to 24 academic year. Some private schools can even increase by a little more than that. Let's get a bit more reaction to this story now from the team at Which Media. The co-founder and general manager of Which Media and the publisher of whichschooladvisor.com is Dave Wesley. David joins us now live on the line, live via Microsoft Teams. Morning, David.
Good morning, Tom. Thank you for having me on.
No, great to hear from you. Great to see you again this morning. And maybe you could just give us a little heads up into terms of, obviously, this news breaking late last week. We've had the weekend to obviously digest it over brunches and otherwise. What are we seeing on the ground? Will all schools hike their rates?
So not all schools will hike their rates, but they have been given the green light to submit an application to raise their rates. So it's not axiomatic that every single school will do. Neither is it that even though a school is entitled to, according to the framework, will it do so. So I think we've already had one school, the Indian High School, saying it's not going to raise its fees next year. It's a value proposition, and it said that, you know, it wants to maintain that value proposition to its parents. But many, many schools will increase their rates. They haven't been able to increase their rates since 2019-20. And we all live in Dubai, so we're all aware that the cost inputs have risen dramatically, whether that's our families or our businesses. And so there's no doubt about it. Schools, in general, will increase their rates. So it's 3% if they maintained their rating, and if they've improved their rating, then there's a sliding scale and they can improve their ratings even more. Interestingly, the ratings increases from lower rated schools get a higher increase than the higher rated schools, which actually makes sense when you think about it.
Look at the percentage increases. You mentioned there 3%, upwards to 6% as well for some particular schools if they have achieved goals accordingly, etc., and met certain criteria. How significant is that when it comes to what one is paying?
Yeah, this is where it gets quite interesting, actually, because in terms of actual raw numbers, obviously the more, the higher your school fees, obviously the greater the actual number. But in general, also, the higher the school fee that you pay, the higher your income, and the less it actually matters. Now, that doesn't mean that people like paying more. But what it does mean is that if we look at the stats, if we look at the surveys that run on our website, we can see that the more expensive the school, i.e. the higher the fees that people pay, the less likely they are to cite school fees in any reason why they choose a school. Moreover, the less likely they are to change schools or switch schools based upon fee increases. So in actual fact, it's not really about the amount, it's about the ability to pay. And actually, those schools that are at the lower end of the segment, the value-based schools, they are the schools that have difficulty when it comes to raising fees. Even if the amount seems relatively small, the ability for parents to pay at that level is much, much harder. So you're likely to get much bigger increases at the more premium schools, but in general, parents can afford to pay, whereas you'll get much smaller increases at the value-based segment, but the parents are much less likely to be able to pay that increase. And that's a kind of interesting phenomenon of this market.
You'd be pushed to find many parents who want to pay a higher school fees. And yet, when you look at the reasons behind this, it's difficult to argue with it. I'll go back to my colleague Richard Dean's thoughts a little earlier on today. Also, Dino Varkey coming out over the weekend saying the decision by the KHDA to increase school fees for the academic year empowers us to invest further in our teachers and facilities. In light of the competition for good teachers and, of course, development of facilities, I suppose there is good reason behind these rate hikes.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest with you, Tom, you just really answered the question in your question. I mean, like, you know, the reality is that, again, especially when you get to the more premium end of the market, school fees are not the most important reason people choose a school. And indeed, you're more likely as a parent to consider your school good value if it charges higher fees, and I'm talking statistics here. And that's because you tend to value things like ECAs, the quality of your teachers, the facilities it provides after school, all of those things. You're far more likely to value those things than the specific amount that you pay. Again, you're absolutely right. No one desires to pay more money, but the notion of value changes as you slide up the scale of school. So Yeah, I mean, I think that really answers it in a nutshell. I mean, like, you know, the world is a competitive place. Everyone wants the best teachers. No parent is going to say, I would accept to have worse teachers, but pay less. People want the best education for their child. And, you know, the only leeway that you have is how efficient schools are run. Hmm. And I would ask you this, Tom, if there were 220 ARNs, if there were 220 talk radio stations, I would imagine that you would be incredibly efficient as an organization. And there are 220 private schools in Dubai. They are, in general, very efficient organizations. They know how to maximize the return. And the only thing I think that schools need to do better, I'm not saying they do it badly, but they could always do it better, is communicate how they're spending their money. I don't think parents want to complain. I think parents in general are looking to be taken on side.
Yeah.
Parents in general are evangelists for their school, but what they want to do is they want to understand how schools are spending their money. And if there is a pay increase, they want to understand where that money is going. Now, if that money is going to go for better teachers, if that money is going to go on more ECAs, if that money is going to go into investment in facilities,
yeah,
I think you'll be hard pushed in many cases to find parents who would disagree with that. But I think the key is, you know, schools cannot get arrogant. Schools cannot become complacent and just think parents are going to hand over their money.
Sure.
Parents can switch. There are so many schools that parents can go to. And I think the more humble a school is and the more willing it's willing to be in terms of being transparent and taking the parents along with them, the more likely it's going to be frictionless as yeah. they basically increase their school fees.
David, got to leave it there. Unfortunately, out of time on this occasion. David Wesley is the co-founder and the general manager of Which Media. They are the publishers of whichschooladvisor.com.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Time for us to talk all things gold as we focus on one of the most important commodities out there. And just a little scanning through some of the headlines at present. Looking at Mint, where it says that the gold price dips as US dollar rebounds from its seven-week low. Buy, hold or exit? Question mark. Traders piling in to bets on gold price rally at the moment, says the Financial Times. And the US dollar retracing from its $2,000 mark on the ease of financial tension. So a lot of chat about the commodity, and there's no one better to talk to us about that than, of course, a great friend of the show, the head of Rhodes Precious Metals and principal consultant at Rack Gold, Jeff Rose, joining us live on the line, live via Microsoft Teams as well. Morning to you, Jeff.
Good morning, Tom.
So let's talk about the price, if we can. Knocking on the door of 2,000. Feasible?
Well, last week, Tom, it traded above 2,000 three times. Last Monday, this time last week, it was 2009, which was the highest price for a year. And then again on Thursday, it hit 2003 and matched that price again on Friday. So three times last week, it traded above 2,000. It didn't end there, though. It ended around 1975. Was a bit disappointing. I think everyone was getting excited that we were heading towards the new all-time high. Just to remind people that the all-time high is 2072 in March 2020. Bit disappointing, but it's still very much in play.
Why are we seeing such moves on the market at the moment?
Well, look, firstly, there's big volume. The last month or so has been the largest trading volume I've seen in a long time, Tom. So it's very much in play. It looked as though 2 weeks ago we were going to be heading lower because the Fed seemed to be on track to be raising interest rates aggressively again. Then, of course, we had the banking crisis. We had the two banks in America that failed. And then we had a week or so ago Credit Suisse, which was the bank I worked for 8 years, had problems and had to be rescued effectively by UBS, a deal which was brokered by the Swiss National Bank. So the problems in the banking sector reminded everyone of what happened back in 2008, 2009 with the global financial crisis and sparked really a stampede into the safe haven of gold.
In terms of outlook for gold as well, with that big question mark around the banking industry at the moment, and obviously Deutsche Bank credit default swaps over the weekend as well, question marks being arised there. We've seen stocks failing or falling over Europe as well. Is this good for gold?
Of course, yes. I mean, it's almost a perfect storm because, you know, we had the dollar coming off a very strong year in 2022, but looking lower. It looks as though the Fed is coming to the end of its rate hiking cycle. But the problem over the banking system has really caused, if you like, large holders of funds, the big funds, to move into the safe haven of gold. And we have something that we hadn't seen for many years, Tom, in 2022, massive buying from central banks. And it looks as though they're back in again this year. Now, if central banks are buying, Tom, they buy to hold. It's not for trading, and it's strategic reasons. And that really makes people concerned. If central banks are buying gold, then perhaps everyone else should be, because the central banks will know things we don't. And as I say, the outlook for gold is good. At the start of the year, I'd predicted a fresh all-time high of 2,100. I think it's very much on track for that, and perhaps higher.
Well, you mentioned there a perfect storm as well, casting your mind back to 2008, 2009. We might ask you to cast your mind back a little bit further as well, Jeff, as well, because it seems that everyone is talking about gold at the moment. It might have something to do with the gold.
Gold like that, you can't control it. And if you can't handle it, then it will find its way to someone who can.
Six robbers have carried out an armed raid, stealing almost 3 tons of gold bullion.
So our friend says you can shift it.
You can handle a job like this, and I'd have heard of you.
You only hear about the people who get caught.
We're looking for 6 robbers and 3 tons of gold.
Still looking for a few of those robbers at the moment as well. But Jeff, listen, renewed interest in all things the gold because of this new BBC series. Have you seen it?
Well, I haven't. You know, based here in UAE, I'm not sure how I can see it. My family have, but I don't need to see it, Tom. I lived it. Yeah, I was a frontline trader at Samuel Montague, one of the 5 members of the gold fixing, when this happened. And of course, the news started to filter into the market on the Monday. Yeah, the robbery took place on Saturday. And it had quite an impact on the price, Tom. On the Friday before the robbery, the price was fixed in London at $375 an ounce. By the Wednesday, when the gold had to be bought back for insurance purposes, the price was 8% higher at $405. And back in those days, we really didn't get big moves in the gold price. And that was a big move, thanks to the gold robbery.
quick question for you about that. One of the things coming off the back of that, saying that since the Brinks Matt job back in the early 80s, every single piece of jewellery that's been bought in the UK has a bit of Brinks Matt in it. Is there anything in that?
No, it's only 3 tons. I mean, although it sounds like a lot, and obviously £26 million at the time was a lot, it really isn't much compared to, I think if I remember correctly, the demand for jewellery each year is give or take 3,500 tons of gold. Mm. So the fact that 3 tons were stolen, it's a good tagline, but not true.
Final question, Jeff. Where is it, the gold that is?
A gold at the moment, 1976. Going to be a quiet week, I think, quieter than last week, trading between probably 1950 and 2000 for the rest of this week.
Final question then, Jeff. Where is the remainder of the Brinks Matt gold?
Well, it's not with me, so I'm not going to say that.
Jeff, you're a good man.
Jeff, just before you go, okay, 6 robbers, 2 were caught. I don't know, you moved to Dubai not long after that.
No. I came to Dubai in 1997, mate.
Jeff Rhodes, good man. Bless you. Thanks so much indeed for your time this morning. Jeff Rhodes from Rhodes Precious Metals and Principal Consultant at Rack Gold, joining us live on the line to talk about what's happening with gold and, of course, that new series as well.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.